Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It was a wild and windy finish at Torrey Pines. We are coming to you on Tuesday for this edition of Monday Scramble. Adjust your calendar accordingly. Rex Hoggard, senior writer for GolfChannel.com. I'm Will Gray. And if that's not enough to get you to buy into this podcast for free, by the way, we do have Ryan Lavner coming up in a few minutes.
A-lister.
Hey, that's what you call a tease here in the industry. But while I have you, Rex, I need to get your thoughts. Brant Snedeker, a champion once again at the Farmers Insurance Open, put together an epic final round on Sunday, won the tournament on a Monday finish without hitting a shot on Monday. Hard to do, but he managed to pull it off, ends up one shot clear of KJ Choi.
I'm interested to hear what Lav has to say about this. He was there. He saw the conditions. Brutal is what it looked like. And by all accounts, that's probably the round of the year. Brant Snedeker's 69 in the final round there. A little early. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. He probably had the best quote of the year up to date, though. He called it a British Open conditions on a U.S. Open golf course. But I think the scoring average was 77.5, somewhere around
there.
Yeah,
somewhere. I think he finished 8 or 9 shots clear, which is, I mean, that speaks for itself. When you beat an elite field on a final round, this is not, you know, a first or second round where you have some higher scores mixed in. I mean, poor Scott Brown, started with a third round lead and he shot an 87. I mean, that shows how hard that course was playing.
And it shows how far Snedeker has come. I mean, this is a guy that not too long ago was shooting 80 something in Australia.
84.
Yeah, and had to fly home with his tail between his legs and go straight to Vegas and work with Butch Harmon. And I think it shows you the things that he and Butch are working on are clearly going in the right directions, because that's just not a good round. But in those conditions, to hit your golf ball like that is phenomenal.
The one comparison I wanted to ask you about, because you were down at Doral last year when J.B. Holmes shot that 62, and that, if you're looking at strokes gained against the field, I think he was 10 or 11 shots better than the average. Snedeker came in 8 or 9 shots clear on Sunday. If you're going apples to apples, which round sticks out to you as a better round?
You know, I was at Doral last year, as you pointed out. It was a very good round. I didn't think at the time that, again, you're better at that sort of math than I am as far as trying to figure out strokes gained. I'm still trying to figure out how to balance the checkbook.
It's not Ivy League.
Not really good at that. Right. But again, I want to hear from Lav, because looking at it on TV, watching it Sunday, and even on Monday as the guys finished up, it looked absolutely brutal. And that golf course is so exposed. It's up there on the cliff, and it was just getting beat up so much. I would give the nod to Brant right now.
Well, without further ado, let's welcome in Ryan Lavner, senior writer. Lav, are you here with us?
Boys, how we doing?
Oh, good to have you.
He sounds wind-whipped, doesn't he?
A little bit. Look at that mug. That's great.
Not a hair out of place.
I have windburn. That's why I'm not in the studio.
Well,
that's
fair
why.
Enough.
Yeah, let's go with that.
So a week in La Jolla, you had about 4 or 5 days of really nice weather, and then you had the apocalypse hit you guys on Sunday. It affected everyone except seemingly Brant Snedeker. So what were your takeaways from a crazy week at Torrey Pines?
I mean, this was really a perfect storm for Snedeker when you think of all the things that had to go right for him to get the W. He needed the cut line to stay at 1 under. He needed, by trailing 6 strokes going into the final round, he needed really bad conditions and the leaders to kind of retreat to him. And he needed to play an epic final round. And that's exactly what he did by shooting 69. Guys, that was more than 9 shots better than the field average when he finished his round. But, you know, standing there outside the scoring area, he still didn't think it was going to be enough. The conventional wisdom would tell you if they're going to stop play, they're not going to send out players back onto the course until it's perfect conditions. And really, on Monday, it was worse. The wind was a completely opposite direction, which made the closing holes really hard, which is why you saw some of the retreats by KJ Choi and Jimmy Walker and, of course, Scott Brown with that 87.
Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head that it wasn't, I mean, you look at the day on Monday and it was sunny and seemed certainly windy, but I think the issue was that the wind flipped directions. So even though it was raining sideways and it was dreary on Sunday when Snedeker was finishing his round, he was hitting drives over 300 yards. He was hitting gap wedge into par fours like 12 and 15. And then you see on Monday when they resume play, KJ Choi can't get there with a fairway wood on a couple of those holes, 14 and 15. And that course, it's already a difficult course worthy of a U.S. Open, but that thing was just turned on its head.
Yeah, when Snedeker woke up on Monday morning, he thought there was no way that he was going to possibly win. The wind was down. It was sunny, like you said. And then as soon as Jimmy Walker got out onto that 11th hole, the wind started blowing again. It was an opposite direction. And I don't think he had one hole that was just straight downwind. Maybe one of the remaining eight. But Sneds really took advantage of five or six holes that were, if they weren't downwind, they were at least down or crosswind with some help. He was able to hit five drives over 300 yards while KJ Choi, as you had, was thumping driver three wood and still coming up short on par four. So it was certainly an unfortunate break for the guys who went out on Monday, but Snedeker was also the guy who was playing through a hurricane on Sunday, and he managed to shoot 300 par.
Yeah, he made the best of the conditions. I think the best example of that is on 18. It was downwind for Snedeker on Sunday afternoon, and it gave him an opportunity to make that birdie, which KJ Choi could not do. Jimmy Walker clearly couldn't pull it off either.
Well, he parred 18.
Well, yeah, but yeah. I mean, it gave him an opportunity as opposed to when the wind switched on Monday and all those guys were playing what is a gettable hole into the wind and suddenly made it, you know, a three-shot hole, and a birdie would have been a heck of a score there.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I want to look back here. Snedeker, this is eight wins for him, but this is his third win when he's entered the final round trailing by five or more shots. What is going on? No one else in the PGA Tour has more than one win within that parameter. I know our stat guru, Justin Ray, was sending out a lot of good stuff just about Snedeker's ability to rally from a deficit in the final round. We saw it 4 years ago at Torrey Pines when he was the beneficiary of Kyle Stanley's 72nd hole collapse. But what is it about Snedeker's game that's allowed him to really rally and grab some of these trophies when other players seemingly are out of contention?
I think when you look at what he does in the final round when he's putting well, I mean, that's really the difference there, because I don't think anyone's ever considered him a great ball striker. But when he starts making those lengthy putts like we saw not only on Sunday but on these various occasions that you talk about, he's unbeatable. I mean, he's almost Spieth-esque because he's making putts that other guys aren't. And I think that's the difference maker.
Lab, you were
Yeah, Rex, when you look at half of his PGA Tour wins now have come when he was trailing by five or more shots heading into the final round. To me, that speaks to his toughness, which is probably not an attribute that you'd think comes to mind when you think of Brant Snedeker, but his attitude is so good. He never gives up. He's gritty. He's competitive. And that short game can really be a great equalizer, especially in the tougher conditions that we saw on Sunday and Monday when you're going to miss a lot of greens. He has the confidence to be able to get up and down and make the best of that situation.
Yeah, it's still amazing to think he made the cut on the number. First guy since 2010 to make the cut on the number and win an event. But one shot here or there, maybe on the North course in the second round, and he's packing his bags like we saw several big names at Torrey Pines.
Well, and Lav, I would be curious. I mean, you talk about that mental toughness, and that's a great attribute to point out, because Brand is, again, you wouldn't look at him as the prototypical player you would expect to go out there and win multiple times and do what he's done on Sunday. But I would also put Jimmy Walker into that category. I mean, I think he's tough. He's proven himself over the last few weeks. How surprised were you that he finished the way he did, even given the conditions?
I was really surprised just considering growing up in Oklahoma, playing college golf in Texas. He thinks playing in the wind is one of his greater strengths. He has no trouble flighting the ball up or down depending on the conditions, and he was just completely out of sorts, beginning with that first tee shot on Monday, that hook over by the car path on the par three, and he opens up with a bogey, and he really couldn't play from there. But from a ball-striking standpoint, this wasn't the best week for Jimmy Walker. It was really his putting that kept him in the mix, going, I believe it was 17 for 17 in the third round, just to give himself a chance from inside 15 feet. So his driver is still a little bit of a work in progress. He's going through that swing change with Butch Harmon now, which is about a month or two old. It's still apparent that he's not quite confident and can't quite find enough balls in the short grass to really give himself a great chance for victories.
Yeah, that first shot from Walker when they came back out on 11, that was really puzzling, as you said, Lav. That was really the only bad shot that he hit over those eight holes when they came back, and it actually seemed like the wind wasn't quite gusting like it was over the last hour or so when they played 15 to 18. But he came out and just sniped that thing left, put himself on the wrong side of the car path. He short-sided, and immediately when you looked at it, you said, all right, he just has to play even par for these 8 holes. All of a sudden, he's tied with Snedeker with no real birdie holes in sight, and the wheels were already falling off from there. But that's how it goes in difficult conditions. Now, turning the page back, Lav, let's look back to Friday, and this was a pretty stacked field with a lot of high-ranked players, most of whom had the weekend off. Ricky Fowler, Jason Day, Phil Mickelson, after that strong play out in Palm Springs, all missed the cut. What were your takeaway from some of the big names swinging and missing early at Torrey Pines?
Yeah, and you could even throw in Justin Rose. Yep. With that mix to miss the cut. But I think each case can probably be examined differently here. I mean, Jason Day, you're not really all that concerned because he had the flu for a week. It was questionable whether he was even going to tee it up, and I actually thought he did well just to miss the cut by a couple of shots. Ricky Fowler, he traveled 17 hours across 12 time zones, and he probably wouldn't have played if it wasn't for a sponsorship deal with the Farmers, so that's not really a concern. Phil was the head-scratching one for me, though, because he played so well on the South Course on Thursday, and then he just completely melted down on the easier North Course, shooting 76 and bogeying the last 3 holes to miss the cut. And, Rex, I'm curious what you think about this. I'm not sure if this was Phil just kind of mailing it in because of his love affair with the Torrey Pines South and North is certainly strained over the past couple of years after the redo and then the failed redesign bid, or whether this was more a product of his inconsistency with the swing that is still a work in progress with Andrew Getson.
Probably a little bit of both, to be honest with you, Lav. I mean, clearly there is a knot that he's not happy that he didn't get the North Course redesign bid. He talked about it last week. He pointed out that he didn't understand the politics that went into it. I'm not going to pretend to understand the politics that went into it. But, again, I'm with you. I think the part that confuses me a little bit is, look, he's split with Butch Harmon. He's going in a different direction with his swing now. He feels like he's getting back to more that feel type of swing that he had earlier in his career. And for a week at the Career Builder, it seemed to work out pretty well, halfway decent. I mean, you can look at it and say that was a decent start for him. This was surprising to me, because you would have thought he would have shown up and had a little bit more confidence in what he was doing, and that didn't look good at all the way he finished.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm going to go as far as to say that he sabotaged his second round there on the North Course because he's picking up his toys
from
the sandbox.
Happy.
He's not happy, but I also think that he's not missing the cut on purpose. But that being said, I think the issue for me with Phil is consistency. I went back. Since the start of the 13-14 season, he has 5 top 10 finishes, which is not a lot, but he has 5, including 2 weeks ago at the Career Builder. In the next start after those top 10 finishes, he has not finished better than a tie for 64th.
That's the consistency, and I think we all wrote about it just a couple weeks ago about what will Phil do next. That's always the big question, going back to that ad campaign, and you just don't know. I mean, you'd like to think that he could turn it around, because I know how much the Ryder Cup means to him this year. I mean, he glared at Davis Love at the President's Cup and said, don't forget me next year when it comes time, either for a pick or to play in the Ryder Cup. He's driven by that, but I don't know that he has the game there. I don't know that he has the swing to be out and compete week in and week out, because you're going to run into a guy like Brant Snedeker, like Ricky Fowler, like Jordan Spieth, like Rory McIlroy, week in and week out, that are playing their best golf. And Phil can't compete if he has his B game now, not against those guys.
Lab, let's
I think
now.
It's more a product of motivation and when Phil is engaged. You saw it at the Masters. You saw it at the PGA when he really has incentive to get the job done. He still has plenty of game to win a major championship. I thought at the Career Builder, he was certainly motivated and engaged to try and start his 2016 off on a good note. I can kind of chalk up the performance at Torrey Pines just the fact that there is a strained relationship now. In the past 15 years, he hasn't won. He's really only seriously contended once over that span. Yes, it's his hometown event, but I'm just not sure he's as motivated to really put on a great performance in his hometown event as maybe he was earlier in his career.
Well, I also think there's something to be said that it seems like the entire West Coast swing is a hometown event for Phil. He play in Arizona, he play in California, and eventually he's going to get tripped up here.
Well, and I think the question was, will Phil win this year? And I actually said yes, but he has to do it quick. Because, the majority of his wins on the PGA Tour have come on the West Coast, and it's getting late early, so to speak, for Phil Mickelson.
It's only February. It's Groundhog Day, right?
But we're sneaking up on the end of the West Coast. And, again, he doesn't often play his best golf after he leaves the West Coast.
All right, Lav, let's talk about someone who actually did make the cut this past week at Torrey Pines, but did not exactly fare well over the weekend. At the halfway point, Dustin Johnson was one shot off the lead, and it seemed like it was shaping up that this could be his tournament. You think of guys that, whose game is ideally suited for the South Course, and it's a burly layout, but DJ certainly has the game to do it. And then he fades back Saturday with a 74, and then all of a sudden, in the tough conditions Sunday, the wheels absolutely came off on DJ. We're looking at the scorecard here. It's six bogeys in his first eight holes. Another weekend meltdown for him on the heels of last season at St. Andrews. He faded over the weekend at Firestone. What are your thoughts on DJ and just his inability to stay near the lead over the weekend?
He just hasn't been the same player since the U.S. Open. I'm not sure he'll ever admit that now he has doubts when it comes to closing out a tournament. But ever since he melted down from the 12-footer at Chambers Bay, he just hasn't been able to get the job done. You mentioned the Open Championship. He had the halfway lead there, and he shot back-to-back rounds of 75. He was tied for second at the Bridgestone, and he ended up shooting 75-76. Even at the World Challenge, Rex, you were out there. He was only a couple shots behind heading into the weekend and completely disappeared over the weekend there. And now Torrey Pines, it was just, I thought it was going to be the perfect storm for him to win, because when you think of Dustin Johnson, you think of a player who can flight his ball just like Jimmy Walker. He's so long that even the into the wind holes, he's going to have an advantage. But his concentration seemed to lapse, and his putting is just so suspect. He looks uncomfortable over the ball, and it almost seems like a miracle when it goes in.
I don't know that it's it, and again, I mean, being in Chambers Bay and speaking with him in the weeks afterwards, I don't think he has. I mean, he's got short-term memory issues, clearly, when it comes to these type of competitive lapses. And I don't think he's clinging to that as much as his ball striking is just not there. And if you put him in a wind, a right-to-left wind, I mean, let's face it, he doesn't hit a straight shot. He likes to rope it a little bit. And if he's in a right-to-left wind, I just think he's going to have a hard time controlling his golf ball. We saw it at Rural St. George's just a few years ago at the Open Championship. I don't think he's that great of a wind player. And right now, I don't think his swing is as good as he wants it to be.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but I think it's funny to think that Dustin Johnson certainly has, he's among the top handful of guys, if you're talking about PGA Tour wins over the last 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. He's got that streak going of having a win every season since, I think, 2007 or 2008. But you almost feel like he needs to get another one. He's going to defend that title at Doral in a few weeks, but he needs to get a win somewhere to kind of get this mini monkey off his back that I think, I agree with Lav, dates back to Chambers Bay and the inability to close it out there.
And I mean, he's got so much scar tissue at this point, doesn't he? Miscues and now this recent trend of weekend retreats. I think you're right. Well, I think he has to get a victory just to remind himself that he is one of the world's best players.
But I think it's a matter of perspective. I mean, if you specifically look at Chambers Bay, it's a matter of, I mean, when you ask him about it, he'll tell you that he felt like he executed every shot perfectly coming down the stretch. Now, three putting the last.
Does he actually believe that?
I think he does. I honestly think he does, because, I mean, anybody will tell you those greens were not conducive to making putts. I mean, there was a lot of dead grass on those greens. They were bumpy. He did not put himself in the best position to be above the hole on the 72nd hole. He wanted the win, and I don't think that one's going to haunt him maybe as much as I mentioned the Open Championship a few years ago. That one's probably the one that sticks with him more.
Royal St. George's,
and Pebble. Pebble 2010.
Yeah,
Pebble.
Well, he was young, and he made some mistakes coming down the stretch.
Even St. Andrews last year, I think, could be as much of a scar tissue creator as Chambers Bay was. If you look back at Chambers, you can say, I played 71 and a half holes really well. I put myself in a position. I'm putting on broccoli or cauliflower or whatever, and it doesn't go my way. Yeah. St. Andrews, he has the pole position at the halfway point, and it's turning into a coronation. And not only does he not win, but he just absolutely implodes. And that's where things change.
Now, what's the common denominator between all those starts? The wind came up at St. Andrews with the storms last week at Torrey Pines, St. George's a few years ago. Again, I don't think he's that great of a wind player simply because his ball striking is not on level of, say, a Rory McIlroy when he's on, or even a Jordan Spieth when he's on his game.
Well, we shall see. Lav, any parting thoughts, any food recommendations from your week out on the West Coast before we let you go?
We're not even going to get into this Ryan Ruffles, Phil Mickelson thing?
Hey, if you...
That was the big story for 3 days there.
Open mic. At it, Lav. Go ahead.
Well, the high school stuff, right?
It was so bizarre because Phil was just asked this innocent question by this local TV reporter who was clearly doing this cute story about a 17-year-old who was making his pro debut. And while Phil was ranting and publicly shaming the 17-year-old for talking about the details of the bet, the face of this reporter was hilarious because her eyes were wide, her mouth was open, and frankly, she had no idea what he was talking about. So the soundbite of, you know, he's a nice kid, but he's got some things to learn. They may have just cut that segment right there, that soundbite right there, because she had no idea what he was going to get into. I think both sides were at fault here, Phil and obviously rookie Ryan Ruffles. I mean, Phil should have approached him in the locker room, should have handled this privately. And Ruffles, Rex, it's like the Fight Club thing. You don't talk about
number one rule
betting
of Fight Club.
Don't talk about betting on the course with Phil Mickelson.
That's it. You just don't talk about Fight Club.
And look, Phil does this week in and week out. We all know that he's got a Tuesday or Wednesday game with whoever it may be. Usually it's Ricky Fowler and Dustin Johnson's in the mix and Snedeker's in the mix from time to time. You don't really talk about what's on the line, though. It's always fun to talk about who won.
Oh, I got into his pocket a little bit.
Oh, yeah, You don't
never
talk. Never.
Is but the amount disclosed.
I would agree. I think this is Phil being a veteran, though, sending a message, and I'm fine with that. I have no problem with him, you know, calling the kid out a little bit in the media and saying...
He's 17! It's high school stuff because
he's not
going to
forget this lesson. He's not going to forget it. I guarantee he doesn't talk about bets anytime in the future, Lab.
It's true. Yeah, you could try and play him for a quarter.
He learned from his mistake, but I have little doubt that the details that he said in that first newspaper article were actually correct.
Oh, I would agree with that. But
really?
you can't talk about it.
Really?
Don't talk about Fight Club.
You're not saying it was $5,000. You're saying
it was exactly. I think Phil was more upset
that the truth
not
got out.
About the details and losing the wager, but I think it was because it ensnared Tim Mickelson, the head coach at Arizona State, into a possible NCAA violation that they had to backtrack and make sure that was clear.
All right. Well, we will see. I'm sure that there will be plenty more side wagers with Phil Mickelson to discuss. Maybe a couple with Ryan Ruffles. You never know. But Ryan Lavner, thank you for joining us. Catch up on your sleep, and maybe we'll see you around the office one of these days.
Next time you're home, we'll play for funsies. Just funsies, Ryan. That's all. No money.
Don't talk about Fight Club, Rex. That's all it is.
I get it.
All right. Well, let's spin it forward here. We've got the Waste Management Phoenix Open coming up this week. Brooks Koepka defending. Champion Bubba Watson, twice a runner-up each of the last 2 years. What are your thoughts on this week's field out of the craziness of TPC Scottsdale?
Well, I started with Brooks. I just did my picks before I came in here for this week. And Brooks impressed me a lot in Maui because of all the talk about the guys who were switching equipment companies this year, and Brooks, of course, went to Nike Golf, he was the one I thought would have the most trouble. Because if you talk about the guys who went to PXG, Zach Johnson, Charles Howe, Chris Kirk, they didn't have to switch golf balls. They didn't have to switch putters. That's always the key for these top-level players who make these huge equipment switches. He came out and played really well in Maui. Now, he didn't play as well as Jordan. No one was going to play as well as Jordan that week. But I like Brooks this week. I like Brooks this year. I think he's motivated. He's focused on the PGA Tour after a few years traveling the world and Europe. And, again, he's another one of those guys like Justin Thomas who has put the Ryder Cup on their radar and are really going to make a run at changing that team this year, at least changing the younger face of that team.
Yeah, for sure. And now we hear news of Jim Furyk being sidelined for another 3 months, and that probably, unless something drastic happens in the summer, probably takes him out of the Ryder Cup, depending on how he bounces back or even when he bounces back. And it just goes to show that this team that Davis Love will have at Hazeltine in the fall is going to look much different than the one that he took to Medina 4 years ago.
That average age of that team could be 25 years old. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, again, it depends on what Jim Furyk does and Phil Mickelson and even Tiger Woods down the line. But if you look at the players who are playing well right now, it could probably be the youngest team in U.S. history simply because the younger players are the ones that are making a difference. Here's a better question when it comes to this week, though, that I'm curious about. Who enjoys that atmosphere the most on tour? I think Pat Perez has a good time in Scottsdale,
yep.
But is he the one that you would pick out?
He's up there. I would lean to the Ryans. I think Ryan Palmer and Ryan Moore both have good success at this event, kind of offbeat picks, but certainly Ryan Palmer. I know last year he's wrapping up dollar bills on golf balls and tossing them in the crowd. Now he's not tossing them that far because the tour police are cracking down. Yeah, they're cracking down on people trying to throw stuff into the crowd. But those are guys that do, certainly Fowler. is another guy that enjoys that atmosphere, getting into the Coliseum of the 16th hole.
Because you have to embrace it, is what I've learned. And you talk to players, and all of them say the same thing to a T, that 1 week out of the year, this is a lot of fun. They don't want it as a steady diet. They like it a la carte. They like being able to come back once a year and enjoy it. And there's some guys that just don't like it. They think it's too rowdy. They don't like the 16th hole. They don't like the atmosphere. Those guys are really not going to have a chance, simply because that crowd's going to dig into you. Yeah. If they know it's getting to you, they're going to be even louder.
Yeah, certainly well hydrated throughout, even for the morning tee times. But even guys, some of the younger guys, Justin Thomas and Daniel Berger, both played really well at Phoenix last year. Thomas was near the 36-hole lead. Berger ended up in the top 10. And those are guys that come out. Certainly Daniel Berger is a guy that would enjoy the party vibe, and he really gets into it. And Thomas has shown last year as well that he just enjoys the raucous crowd there on 16. And even 17 this year, they've built up some new grandstands around the lake there on 17. So it's really turning it 15, 16, 17 into a pretty crazy 45-minute stretch for these players.
And there's an MO to the winners that win here. I mean, let's face it, you have to be a bomber. You have to be able to move it out there. You have to be able to ignore all of the bunkers, know that you're going to carry them. I mean, J.B. Holmes was another guy that caught my eye, a two-time winner here. He's playing pretty well right now. Anybody who can carry the ball 310 yards, that's probably where you start your list and work your way back.
What about Snedeker? The hottest man in golf, going 3-2-1 over the last three starts. He's rolling right along. He's going to play this week in Phoenix. He's going to defend the title at Pebble next week, when he's going to go for 3 wins in 4 years, actually, out in Pebble. I mean, do you think that he can continue this hot streak?
It's going to be hard for him, as I just pointed out. It's a bomber's golf course if you look at the guys who have won here, played
well.
Three
top tens in the last 5 years, though. He's played pretty well. He doesn't have a win, but he's got a good record there.
I think the great equalizer when it comes to this golf course, and less so for the South course, because they've made the South course, ever since the Reese Jones redesign right before the Open in 2008, they made it much more of a position golf course where everyone was kind of playing to the same spot. They over-exaggerated the dog legs a little bit. This is still a bomber's golf course. I mean, even after the changes they made 2 years ago, you still just stand on tees and swing as hard as you can, and you go up and find it. And for a guy like Brandt to win, or a guy like who doesn't hit it quite as far, KJ Choi coming off a great week, for them to do it, they have to execute every part of their game to perfection. And it's hard to do that over four rounds.
I want to quickly go back to this past weekend, because you brought up something we were talking before that I think is interesting. European Tour event in Qatar ended on Saturday. Brandon Grace, who's now 11th in the world, successfully defended his title. He's gone back-to-back. And you feel like he is in the mix, if we're discussing best players without a major, alongside the likes of Ricky Fowler, Dustin Johnson, Henrik Stenson, guys like that.
I don't think he's finished outside the top five since before the PGA last year. I mean, he's just been on a phenomenal run. What he did at the President's Cup, going undefeated, I mean, obviously he was paired with Louis, and those two guys had a good chemistry going, but Louis wasn't playing his best golf. That was all on Brandon, more or less, and I think that just has built his confidence. Now, if we're going to have the actual debate about who is the best player without a major, which is a dubious title, I don't think anybody wants that saddled on him. I would have to give it to Ricky right now. But it's a very tight race, because I think Brendan Grace is going to be the type of player that is going to force his way into the American psyche. A lot of fans don't know a lot about him because he spends more time in Europe. But he's playing so well week in and week out. He was in contention in Abu Dhabi, wins Qatar. I'm not going to be surprised if another top five this week in Dubai.
Do you feel like he needs to play more in the States in order to get that brand awareness and for golf fans to realize, hey, this guy is a world-class player. He's won a bunch, I think, 7 times in the European Tour. He's right on the heels of the top 10 in the world ranking. He is at that point of elite.
I think eventually he kicks down the door. We just got through talking about Dustin Johnson at Chambers Bay last year, and if it wasn't for a foul ball, I think it was on the 16th hole, when he puts it on the train tracks. We're probably talking about Brendan Grace as the U.S. Open champion right now. So, no, I don't think he has to play more in the United States. Eventually it's going to happen, because he's going to get one of those big breakthrough victories. And certainly if he didn't turn a lot of heads at the President's Cup last year, I don't know when he ever will. But I think he's a different kind of cat when it comes to scheduling. I can see him playing less in the United States and more in Europe, simply because that's where he's comfortable.
Yeah. I wanted to revisit, we discussed it briefly before, but Furyk's wrist injury, out for another 3 months. He's going to have surgery. This seems like an issue. It's crazy. When you go back and think, when he pulled out at the BMW in September, the question was, are you going to play the Tour Championship next week? Are you going to play the President's Cup? I mean, this was a injury that they thought was going to keep him out for days or weeks. And then even once he was out of the President's Cup, he was all downhill towards, I'm going to go to Maui. He had worked so hard to get that win at the Heritage. He's going to play Maui. Then he doesn't play Maui. He targets Pebble. Now he's out of Pebble. I mean, this thing has just really snowballed on Jim Furyk, who was up to number three in the world ranking last summer and now is nowhere to be seen.
I think it's concerning because you're talking about a 40-something. You're talking about
45.
A guy. Yeah, yeah, I mean, you're talking about a guy who is up there in years. And look, as well as he has played deep into his 40s, there is still a limited window. You still don't have unlimited time. You're not a 25-year-old. You don't rebound from things as quickly as you do when you're younger. So for Jim, I think it's very concerning simply because he doesn't have that stretch in front of him where he can say, okay, well, I can take 6 months off and get this fixed. I mean, it's a similar conversation to what we're having about Tiger Woods these days, simply because you don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I just, again, like we said, he's 45, and it strikes me that I don't think he ever really realized the severity of this injury. He puts out his release through his management company on Monday, and they say, well, he's going to have surgeries out 3 months. And the hindsight view is, well, if you would have had the surgery originally, you'd be back and playing, and you would be at Pebble Beach where he likes to start his season. But I don't think that he ever really knew that this was as bad as it turned out to be.
Well, and I think when you're 45, you lean away from having surgery simply because if you can do it another way at 45 years old, you're going to try to do it another way. I mean, surgery is clearly a last resort, and I think he probably felt like that with some rest and some rehab, he could get it to a point where he could still be competitive. He has done it throughout his career. I mean, no one has grinded out a career like it. Is that right?
Grinded. I'll give you grinded. That's fine.
Ground out. That seems better. No one has ground out a career like Jim Furyk. I mean, this is a guy who wasn't even recruited because of his swing, and he wanted to keep that same unique swing, and he has done phenomenal things with it.
So we've made it a pretty far length into this podcast so far. We survived the Ryan Lavrick gauntlet, but we have not mentioned world number one, Jordan Spieth, whose Asian world tour has now come to a close. He went from Abu Dhabi to Singapore.
Just world tour. You don't even call it Asian, world tour.
He's going anywhere that will have him, let's say. He comes up one shot short at the Singapore Open, came back on another Monday finish, had to hit a 5-foot birdie putt, which he did make, but I'm sure he and agent turned caddy Jay Danzi would have rather gotten out of town and seen how things went.
Everybody in the golf world was giving him that putt.
Yeah.
Just give him the putt.
It's
Jordan Spieth. It's 5 feet. Of course it can.
So he finished the second at the Singapore Open. He continues to play well since he left the field at the Hyundai Tournament of Champions. But I wrote something on Sunday for golfchannel.com that I'm a little concerned about looking at his schedule leading into the Masters and how much gas is going to be in the tank when he hits the big events, the ones that he says are important, not only the Masters, but then you're looking at two majors in 3 weeks this summer. He's for sure going to be at the Olympics. And, you know, the Masters right now is going to be third week in a row. It's going to be ninth event out of 12 in a 12-week stretch. He's playing each of the next 2 weeks at Pebble and Riviera. What are your thoughts on the 22-year-old with apparently infinite energy?
It's too much travel. It's too much golf. He admitted as much when he left Abu Dhabi when I spoke with him. And he'll look at this and he won't do it again. I mean, just go back to last year. I mean, when he finishes the season, he goes to Korea, he goes to Australia, starts out in Maui, Abu Dhabi, Singapore. I mean, it's just kind of snowballed.
And he racked up the miles. Good frequent flyer account.
And he was tired. And what's interesting, I was on the plane ride home from Abu Dhabi with another European tour player, and I was kind of saying how tired Jordan said he was, and the other player had no sympathy for him because he's 22 years old. He's not in 33F like you and I. I mean, he's flying on a private plane. That being said, I think he's learned a lot from this stretch, and I would expect him not to do it again. Now, you asked me, what do we expect out of him at Augusta? I was probably the most impressed with Jordan last year, regardless of everything else he did. I mean, just a phenomenal year in the majors alone. But what he did when he wins the tour championship after missing a cut in the playoff, and his explanation after the fact was, we knew coming in with our position that all we had to do was win East Lake. Forget about what happens in the first three events. If we win East Lake, we get it done. They treated East Lake like a major, and he got it done. So he has an amazing ability to compartmentalize and decide, okay, these are the important events, and these are the events that I'm going to play. These are the ones that matter. And I think that's what he's going to do at Augusta.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that he's going to be in good shape when Augusta rolls around, just because it might be a little winded, but I mean, he's got a lot of events before he gets there. He says he's going to play the Shell Houston Open, where he lost in the playoff last year. The match play is moving to Austin. He has an affinity, certainly, for all the Texas events, which now there are 5 PGA Tour events in Texas.
And the match play.
I do think that the Asian swing of his world tour, as we said, that it was somewhat out of a sense, not necessarily obligation, but he feels a sense of duty as the world number one player to kind of spark a little bit of interest and growth in the global game. He had said he wanted to get to Abu Dhabi for the last couple of years. This year it lined up. So there's that. He's certainly, the bank account is probably a little healthier.
I was about to say, let's don't gloss over
that. It's a little healthier.
I've been impressed by everything Jordan has done. In my mind, he really hasn't taken a wrong step in his career. Maybe skipping the Bridgestone a couple of years ago, but now now we're just nitpicking. But come on, the bank account got a boost.
Hey.
Let's don't ignore it. I mean, he's not...
Check's got it clear.
He's going around the world. He wants to be a global player, and along with that comes a lot of zeros. Yep. So that's all you need to worry about.
That is true. And it is interesting that this is not something that we saw from Tiger Woods. The Tiger was one thing that made Tiger Tiger is that he's got his set of events, and these are the events that I'm going to play, and these are the one-offs I'm going to do with Nike or with other sponsors, and that's it, and I'll see you when I see you.
Well, and I think, I mean, there's a lot of key differences between Jordan Spieth and Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy and Tiger Woods, and this is one of the big ones. I'm not saying that this is wrong for Jordan. I'm not saying this is wrong for Rory. Look, you can't sit here and argue that what Tiger did over that decade, that two decades of dominance, was the wrong schedule. To play 15 times and peak at the right times, clearly it was. 14 majors answers that question for you. Time will tell with Jordan. I mean, if he gets to Augusta and he's tired and he ends up finishing T25, then we can have a longer conversation about this. But he has proven himself resilient, and he's proven that he's his own man. I mean, these are the things he wants to do. He wanted to go back to Australia. He enjoyed himself. I think Abu Dhabi was a great decision for him because it exposes him to a little bit different form of competition. Brooks Koepka talks about it all the time, the things he learned from traveling the European Tour for those years. And I think these are going to help him in the end, but there's a fatigue factor that we'll have to see how it plays out.
We will see. Jordan Spieth not in action this week, but plenty of other golfers
sleeping.
Are.
He's on the couch.
He's sleeping somewhere trying to adjust the body clock. But let's look at this week in golf. We've got plenty of action. The Waste Management Phoenix Open, as we discussed, the Omega Dubai Desert Classic, where Rory McIlroy will look to win again, which seems to be just an annual ATM for him. The Champions Tour heads to Boca for the Allianz Championship out of Broken Sound. And we have the Coates Golf Championship in Ocala for the LPGA. And I want to touch on that because it's an interesting first-round pairing on Wednesday. We have Suzanne Pettersen playing with Allison Lee. It's Concession Gate playing out all over again.
Pick it up.
From the Solheim Cup, the concession that wasn't. Both women have said that they've kind of tried to bury the hatchet. Certainly easier for Allison Lee to do so than maybe Suzanne Pettersen, who kind of became the villain in all this. But what are your thoughts on the LPGA bringing the two of them together?
Give the LPGA credit, man. If they're talking about you, it's a good thing.
And
they're going to be talking about that this episode this week. And you know what? I mean, obviously the two players probably still are stinging a little bit. I mean, Suzanne spoke about this recently and said she didn't like the way it was handled by the U.S. team. I think everyone immediately looked at what Allison did and thought, well, it was a completely innocent mistake. I think a lot of people, myself personally, I went to the rules of golf. It's ridiculous. She should have just put the ball back down and
put it back
it out.
And play it.
I mean,
it's easy.
It's funny. Let's look at the game from 30,000 feet. And if you've never played the game and you're watching that, you think it's the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen. Just put the ball back down. Put it out. But the LPGA, Michael Wan, the people who call the shots over there, I think it's a brilliant move. Because, look, if they're talking about you, it's a good thing.
No such thing as bad publicity, right?
No such thing.
All right, one more big game this week. Super Bowl 50 out in the West Coast. Lab shouldn't have left California. Real quick, give me your predictions. Denver, Carolina.
What's the line?
Lines drifting towards +6. I kind of like Denver +6.
Oh, +6.
+6, catching six. Cam might get that trophy, but defense usually wins these games.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
don't they always say that defense is what wins you championships?
The Ravens defense, the
Cam
the
is
Bucks.
Entertaining. I mean, you love watching them, but I mean, I've been told, I coached my son's basketball team last night, and I swore to them that defense wins championships, so I guess I got to stick with that and go with the Broncos. I like getting the points, too, though.
How'd that hoops action go for you?
Well, I'm good at motivational speech.
That's good. Only one Hall of Fame quarterback has won the Super Bowl in his last game. That was John Elway.
John Elway.
Peyton Manning might have the same walk-off. We'll have to see. But that's going to wrap it up for this Tuesday edition of Monday Scramble. Rex Hager, thanks for joining me. Ryan Lavner, he hung up long ago, but maybe he'll hear these things anyway. We'll be back on Monday. Fingers crossed we'll get back on schedule. But thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.